difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to The Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast dedicated to a classic film and how it's shaped our thoughts on a current release. I'm Tosh Robinson, here with
Keith Phipps,
Genevieve Kosky,
Scott Tobias.
Here on The Next Picture Show, we believe that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. This week, we're stealing the show with a pair of heist movies, both about a crew of specialists working like a well-oiled machine to steal a huge pile of money generated by a popular sporting event. In both cases, the thieves claim to have thinly drawn moral reasons, but they're really motivated by family. And in both cases, the actual motive is to entertain the audience by making the heist as convoluted and personality-driven as possible. Okay, Genevieve, what kind of crew do you think we're going to need to introduce these two films? I'm thinking a Boesky, a Jim Brown, a Miss Daisy, two Jethros, and a Leon Spinks, and the biggest Ella Fitzgerald ever.
Or you could just have me do it?
And what's the fun in that?
Put it this way. The version where I just explain this won't take 2 hours of banter, character building, and plot fakeouts. Here's the gist. Steven Soderbergh made Logan Lucky and Ocean's 11 16 years apart, but they have a lot in common, both in focus and structure. They both start with a mastermind who wants to pull off a heist and has to assemble a crew of old familiars to do it. Both films follow the process of building the team, then building the scheme. And then both films launch into the action, taking us through the big theft, then dropping back to reveal there was more going on than the audience realized. But the two films also have some significant differences. Ocean's 11 is a remake of a 1960 heist film starring Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr., and Soderbergh's version keeps some of the original film's jazzy swagger and sense of cool. It's set in a Las Vegas full of slick high rollers and high-tech con artists. Logan Lucky jumps between West Virginia and North Carolina, and its band of thieves are blue-collar workers and good old boy rednecks, and the film mocks some of them more than it admires them. We'll get into some of the class and culture differences between the two films as we look at how Soderbergh tells two similar stories in two different settings.
That'll also give us a good opportunity to talk about some of the cinematic tricks both Logan Lucky and Ocean's 11 are using, from the myth of the gentleman thief to the heist movie that deceives the audience as it's deceiving its patsies. In this part of this week's podcast, we'll talk about the Ocean's 11 series and what it says about Steven Soderbergh's affection for smooth criminals. And on Thursday, the second half of the show, we'll look at Logan Lucky's much less smooth operators and how they keep their motives just as mysterious. So keep your wallets close and your security badges closer as we explore some imperfect crimes.
It's never been done before.
What's the target?
When was the last time you were in Vegas?
You want to knock over a casino?
Three casinos?
Vegas, huh?
Vegas?
Vegas.
Fantastic.
The heist is impossible.
Casino security cannot be beaten. You're out of your minds.
Exactly.
You are up to something, Danny. What? You're pulling a job, aren't you? You're a thief and a liar.
I only lied about being a thief.
You're gonna need a crew as nuts as you are. Who do you got in mind?
Smash and grab job, huh? Slightly more complicated than that.
Say we get down the elevator we can't move, and past the guards with the guns, and into the vault we can't open. We're just supposed to walk out of there with $150 million in cash.
Yeah.
Oh.
But these guys...
That is the sexiest thing I have ever seen.
...are just crazy enough...
You'd need at least a dozen guys doing a combination of cons.
Do you understand any of this?
I'll explain later.
...to pull off the con...
Someone call for a doctor?
...of the century.
These days, we think of Steven Soderbergh as a remarkably eclectic director who dips into whatever genre is interesting him at the moment, and a film like Logan Lucky doesn't seem particularly out of place in his filmography. But back in 2000, Soderbergh was more known as an erratic filmmaker without a fixed or predictable voice. His tender, low-key debut, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, was hard to reconcile with his propulsive thug thriller, The Limey. And neither one of them fit with his surreal meta-experiment Schizopolis, much less his crowd-pleasing mainstream A Mom on a Mission film Aaron Brockovich, or his sprawling, Best Director-winning crime drama Traffic. So while Ocean's 11 came as a surprise because Soderbergh wasn't really known for this kind of high-gloss, banter-heavy caper movie, it maybe wasn't as much of a surprise as it might have been if he'd been working consistently in one genre or story mode throughout his career. If anything, Ocean's 11 at least had a little more precedent than some of his projects. If critics were looking to puzzle out Soderbergh's interest in remaking a 1960 Rat Pack movie with George Clooney in the Frank Sinatra role, they could at least point to Soderbergh's 1998 thriller Out of Sight, which also starred Clooney and was also a heist movie with a nonlinear story and an ensemble of famous faces. Still, writing for the New York Times in 2001, Elvis Mitchell said this, "This movie is an odd choice for Mr. Soderbergh, who is perhaps the ne-plus-ultra director of films about people living on the margins. I'm not sure why he chose to remake Ocean's 11, a movie so much about insiders that the stars of the original couldn't have cared less if there was an audience for the picture." Mitchell does have a point about Soderbergh's strengths, but even if the film seems like a stretch for him, it's still a delight. Clooney's Danny Ocean, a career con man, wants to reclaim his masculinity from casino owner Terry Benedict, who's currently dating Danny's ex-wife, Tess. So Danny sets out to rob three of Terry's casinos, with the help of a crew of con job professionals played by several generations of movie stars, including Elliot Gould and Carl Reiner, Brad Pitt and Bernie Mac, Don Cheadle and Casey Affleck. There are a wide range of ages and styles here. But screenwriter Ted Griffin gives most of them snappy banter or kvetchy monologues as they all pile on the quirks. They may be insiders in the sense that they're successful professionals who walk away with millions, but they're outsiders in that they're all mismatched oddballs who are hard to reconcile with any kind of real-world profession or situation. They're all types. They're all functions as much as they are characters. And for most of them, the movie isn't about who they are so much as how they function. Griffin's script lays out part of an initial plan, starting with a list of types Pitt's character thinks will be necessary to pull off the scheme. Then the story jumps into the middle of the heist, where we watch things going wrong that aren't necessarily actually going wrong. Finally, the film pulls back to redefine what we just saw. It's a hat trick of a movie, memorable as much for its slick speed and its rabbit-from-a-hat sleight of hand as it is for any particular moment or character. But audiences certainly did find it memorable and worthy of revisiting. Ocean's 11 was a monster box office hit for Soderbergh, an $85 million movie that brought in more than $450 million worldwide and spawned two significantly less memorable sequels. Today, it feels a bit like one of those one-for-the-studio, one-for-me projects that can bankroll and justify any number of smaller, more personal films. But at the same time, there's something quintessentially Soderberghian about Ocean's 11 and his fascination, not just with the grumpy loner outsiders who fight for what they believe in, but with the slick outsiders that come together to break the bank and walk away as winners.
What?
I need a reason.
Don't say money. Why do this?
Why not do it?
Because yesterday I walked out of the joint after losing 4 years of my life and your cold decking teen beat cover boys. Because a house always wins. Play long enough, you never change the stakes, the house takes you. Unless, when that perfect hand comes along, you bet big and then you take the house.
Been practicing that speech, haven't you?
A little bit. Did I rush it? Felt like I rushed
it. No, it was good. I liked it. Teen beat thing was harsh.
So we're a couple of sequels into the Ocean's series, and there's an all-woman remake coming up on the horizon. After all of that, how does Ocean's 11 play for you guys today? Scott?
Pretty well, I would say. pretty well. I mean, I think the sequels, particularly the second one, do stick to the ribs a little bit more than you imply in your keynote. But I do still quite like Ocean's 11. I've seen it many times. This is an easy movie to see, and I think that's kind of the point of it. It's funny how, you know, on this show we like to dig into the deeper themes of what certain films have to offer, and I actually do think that Ocean's 11 is a surface level kind of experience by design, and we can maybe get into that a little bit, but it is about Soderbergh showing off his dexterity as a filmmaker and as a storyteller, him showcasing this range of stars and the glitz and glamour of Vegas and, you know, just the fun of pulling the wool over the audience's eyes. I mean, I think that is its primary mission. And for me, hard for me to find a whole lot of subtext to dig into below that. But I don't know if others have that experience with it or not.
Well, I mean, I don't think I make a great case for its deep subtext, but I think it is a wonderful example of what you want from a Hollywood movie sometimes.
Oh, sure.
I mean, it is pure pleasure, this movie. I really enjoy watching it. And, you know, sometimes you want to see Brad Pitt, like, get in and be a really tortured, really kind of disappear into a character. Sometimes you just want to see Brad Pitt be a really handsome, charming man on the movie screen. Mm-hmm. And this gives you that. And George Clooney and Julia Roberts, it's just, and the dialogue, too, is such, you know, you don't get dialogue that crisp as often as you want it. I mean, there's just exchanges in here that are just so compact and witty, and they stick in the mind. Like the line is like, you know, does he make you laugh? Well, he doesn't make me cry. It's just a wonderful, you know, and that tells you so much about those characters' relationship in just a minimal amount of words. It's wonderful. And like at this point, he was so confident behind the camera and so willing to try different things that you know, really don't usually try to get away with in a big budget Hollywood movie and get away with it beautifully here. I'm a big fan of this film.
Yeah, third that. And I agree, especially in terms of the dialogue and especially in terms of the Danny Tess banter, which I think is kind of the only really reason for the Tess character to be in this movie, because that those conversations between Julia Roberts and George Clooney are just so electric on screen. To go back to what we were saying about this being kind of a surface level movie, I agree that like I don't think there is necessarily a deeper thematic reading here, and I don't think Soderbergh would say this, but I do think that you can kind of look at this as not exactly a movie about movie making, but a movie that is about showing off the skill and the sleight of hand that goes into movie making. And, you know, I was reading some interviews with Soderbergh about how he was very anxious to make this film. And like, it was a lot of stuff that he hadn't done before. And just in terms of all the moving parts, he knew he was going to have to manage in the shot composition and the editing and how he was going to pull this off. I think it feels like an echo of what is happening on screen in terms of them pulling something off that's very complicated and a lot can go wrong and high stakes and all that. So yeah,
you don't see any sweat though. It seems so effortless and like willing to do.
And
like,
you don't see any sweat in the characters either,
right? Exactly.
There's a little bit
except
of sweat.
except for the nervous guy.
And there's some sticky situations.
When the nervous guy gets lost Livingston. Behind the scenes, Livingston, when he's yeah. when he loses it for a second, when he loses the plot, as it were, the people watching him on screen are definitely sweating.
And the acrobat getting stuck in the vault.
There's definitely some sweat when he gets his hand caught. Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, they are cool, collected.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Soderbergh has expressly said that making a film is like doing a criminal heist. That like, I mean, he's made that comparison very clear.
Oh, and here I thought I was smart.
I thought you were just sort of being subtle about the things that he said in interviews. But yeah, he definitely sees a comparison there. And when he says that, what I see is not so much movie making actually being like pulling off a heist as I see his admiration for these characters. Like the fact that he thinks these guys are really pretty cool. And this movie just feels like it's sitting back and admiring these guys, regardless of what they do. To the degree that Ocean's 11 doesn't work for me, it's because that sense of admiration is so strong that to me, the movie doesn't really interrogate anything going on here, like why they're doing it, how what the motivation for people is besides money. Like, what do they all need the money for? Like, by the end of the movie, Bernie Mac's out of a job and could probably use that money. But, you know, for everybody else, it's just sort of it's assumed like there's money and we want it. So, of course, we're going to do something incredibly Rube Goldbergian to take it.
Well, I think, I mean, these are, for the most part, career criminals. And yeah. I think it's definitely established that for some of them, like Brad Pitt's character and Carl Reiner's character, like they have been out of the game and they kind of relish the opportunity to show that they still got it.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, they are criminals going after a big score. Money is definitely a motivating factor. But I do like that observation about Carl Reiner's character in particular, about just like, I think there's just an excitement about working with this team and, mm-hmm. and doing something impossible and incredible and somehow pulling it off. I don't think he's the type of guy who is in any mood to accept a proposition like this until it comes to him and the circumstances sort of reveal themselves as appealing. Almost like if you want to use a movie metaphor, it's almost an artistic impulse to want to be a part of something like this.
Yeah, to quote Soderbergh real quick, he, when describing Saul Bloom, Carl Reiner's character, he said, "I always imagined Saul to be like a woman who used to be asked out a lot and now isn't asked out at all and hasn't been asked out for a long time, but is still very proud. When Saul is approached by Rusty, he feigns disinterest when in fact he desperately wants to be in on it. He's trying not to let on how much this caper means to him."
But see, I feel like that is a deeper take on that character than the film necessarily gets you. Now, I am not saying that this film could in any way be improved by an hour of the Wire-esque backstory and investigation into each of the characters. I do feel that if you don't share the film's admiration, this would be like a very shallow and unsatisfying experience. And it's the degree to which Soderbergh and Griffin, who, you know, is providing the dialogue, and the actors, who are very charming people,
it's a pretty good cast.
Yeah, it's a hell of a cast. And I think, I mean, I think that this movie, like, works like the machine it's trying to emulate. And you can just feel where if, like, any of the gears slipped, the whole thing might fall apart. Because it is, as Scott says, it's a very shallow endeavor. But I think one of the keys to it, which Scott also kind of touched on, is that part of the fun of a heist movie is, like, these guys all kind of respect each other and admire each other. And some of them flip each other crap. It reminded me a little bit of the Fast and Furious movies in that sense, mm-hmm. is there's that sense of affection between them that sometimes comes with ribbing each other super hard. It feels like a hangout movie. It feels like a hangout movie where everybody's very busy all the time, but you get to spend some time with, like, a lot of very charismatic people who seem to enjoy each other's company.
And I like that there are no twists that involve any of them betraying each other.
Sure.
There is that honor among thieves. That's an idea that's accepted and not questioned, or it doesn't become a reveal in itself. There are other twists that the film would rather, you know, reveal to you, which is just how they do this incredible thing of, you know, robbing three casinos. And so I appreciate that. And it makes it fun. It makes it feel, again, that sort of team effort. The other thing I would want to say about Ocean's 11 too is I think it may have been Soderbergh's idea of presenting the state of the Hollywood star, certainly the male star, but I guess you have Julia Roberts in here as well, you know, at the turn of the century. Like, because I mean, what other film are you going to turn to just to really get a sense of, like, who are the most glamorous dudes out there? And it's these guys. I mean, I guess, and that's maybe the connection to that Rat Pack film too, is just this is what cool looks like in the year 2001.
Yeah, if you're going to remake the quintessential Rat Pack movie, you better have the contemporary equivalent of the Rat Pack. Perhaps not as many multifaceted talents there. I haven't bought any George Clooney albums lately, but but certainly I don't think anyone felt let down. You're not getting, like, the third tier stars.
And to kind of go back to the conversation about this being a sort of shallower surface level movie, I mean, it's set in Vegas. Like, yeah. I think that is very purposeful. I mean, obviously the original is set in Vegas too, but I think in terms of choosing to do this story and choosing how to do this story, like, it's set in a city that is all about glitz and glamour and appearances and the what's on the surface and money. And, you know, like, it feels like a very Vegas movie. I mean, obviously you can make a, you know, a more complex, thoughtful movie about Vegas, but you can also make this kind of movie about Vegas and it works really well.
It's also, I mean, this is a really big cast. There is not a whole lot of time to dig deep into people's backstories.
How many people are on the team in this one?
I think 13.
Okay. It's around a dozen.
Yeah. it's like a baker's dozen where the baker already ate two of them. I mean, don't you remember the scene with Clooney talking to Pitt where he's like, we've got 10. 10 is good, right?
Yeah.
Dead silence.
You think we need one more?
You think we need one
there's
more?
There's so many fun winks in this movie. One I didn't even catch when they're doing the hilarious poker instruction with the young stars in Hollywood. Oh. There's a line of dialogue I caught what George Clooney's character says to Topher Grace's character. So is it hard making the transition from TV to film?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And Topher Grace is saying, like, not for me, which, well, you know, that maybe didn't work out quite that well.
He was ascendant at the time.
Yeah.
that's another moment that plays kind of differently today, because, like, those guys aren't exactly the up and coming, like, shining stars of today.
They haven't supplanted the Clooney's and Pitts of the world.
Yeah, and one of the laughs in that scene is how they start referring to them on the first name basis. Mm-hmm. Like, audience of the future may not know who Topher Grace is. So Topher, him calling him Topher.
I mean, Topher is going to be a funny name no matter what.
That is true.
And sorry, you know, to any Topher listeners.
Even for an audience that does not know all of those boys by their first names.
And one girl
who barely speaks.
Yeah.
All Reds is still a laugh line to play.
All Reds.
All Reds.
Yeah. Oh, and you have six cards. It's fine.
So, I mean, what do you guys think of this, like, as a Soderbergh film? Like, do you, looking back on his career, as I was prepping the keynote, and looking back on what kind of some of the things people have said about him at various points of his career, he's just got a really eclectic career. But I've come across a handful of sort of, like, maybe we can tie Soderbergh together theories. Do you guys have any? Is there anything here that specifically ties this to his filmography for you?
Well, you know, I was, when you were getting to that part of your keynote, I found myself objecting to little bits about how Skitsopolis and the Limey are not like each other when I thought think they have absolutely everything in common. But I think there was a point, again, on a surface level, he's really interested in constructing films precisely. I mean, he's involved now in every aspect of filmmaking. He is Peter Andrews, the cinematographer. Now he's right up there in the mix. And I think
also Marianne Bernard,
the editor. So he's his presence is felt in every critical aspect of the production. And
now they're saying that he may also be the screenwriter of Logan Lucky under yet another name.
I thought that
name.
Was his wife.
Yeah.
There's a lot of theorizing.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
But we can talk about that,
that
in the second
collaboration,
hand.
But.
But in terms of what you were saying about him having like his hands in every part, like he does not usually write his films.
That's true. Which
is kind of an interesting wrinkle in any unified theory of Soderbergh, you know. But he is obviously selecting what scripts he would like to
direct. He'll rework things too. I mean, The Limey being a very famous example of that with that commentary track.
the best commentary track ever, where the
screenwriter Lem Dobbs is getting on his case for totally messing with the screenplay.
Here's another scene. And you messed up. Here's some of that Tarantino nonsense you like to add in.
Yeah. But to me,
he started as an editor. I think he has so much respect for just how a film is put together and what a cut here and a cut there and the way film can play with time. He's tough to pin down because makes so many different types of movies. Yet I feel that there's kind of this command of film craft that runs through it all. And if you want to like draw a line in his career, to me, he kind of runs out of steam with like the first wave of what he can do after The Underneath. And then Skitsopolis, that strange experimental film where he's, you know, self-financing, he's starring in it, he's just putting up whatever crazy idea he can get on there. I think it kind of liberated him because I think you get a really great stream of films after that. I mean, Out of Sight and The Limey and Traffic and this and Aaron Brockovich all in a row where it seems like there's this influx of new ideas and new techniques. And I think that to me is kind of the application of that phase to the biggest possible Hollywood project you could have, or at least a very large scale Hollywood movie.
And I mean, I think Ocean's 11 and Logan Lucky is a very clear example of one of his biggest preoccupations as a director, which is money and class and like how it affects what people do and how they relate to each other. In that respect, this pairing like just could not be more Soderberghian.
In a way, the one thing that is missing here, though, is need, right? You don't get a sense that any of these guys need this heist in the way they might in other films where money is a really important motivating factor.
I mean, Danny Ocean is an ex-con just out of prison. I mean, they famously don't have the biggest leg up.
Could this guy not make $10,000 just the moment he steps out of prison?
Also, I don't think that I don't think that what we see him needing in this movie is money. We see him needing is Tess. And I think that moment where he sits down and talks to her, and it's a very pushy, almost sleazy moment where she keeps saying, you know, no, go away. And he keeps ignoring her and doing what he wants. And then Andy Garcia shows up and takes his seat and takes Tess's hand and starts looking into her eyes. And Clooney stands there over the two of them with just this sense of like revulsion and almost desperation that we don't see in him at any other point in the movie. I mean, when a thug comes to beat him up, he has complete control over that situation. He's planned for it. When things go wrong on the heist, they're all part of the plan. But that moment over the table, I think you see like just like a naked hurt in him where he knows that the cool thing to do would be to turn his back on the table and walk away. And he can't do it. And he's hurting. And I think that's the only real moment of vulnerability we get with him.
Clooney is so good also at conveying a lot of emotions while grinning.
Yeah.
I mean, just the eyes.
A raised eyebrow.
Yeah, these sort of these subtle inflections. I mean, it's why he's a movie star. That's what a movie star can do.
He's also you can't beat the voice. You can't beat the voice and the smoothness of his affect for a role like this where what he's trying to bring across is consummate control and professionalism. He's really good.
Yeah, and Brad Pitt, that applies to him too in this movie. Like, they're just, as we said, it's a hell of a cast, but like that pair specifically, George Clooney is the idea man and Brad Pitt is the detail man, you know. It's just, and they both have a similar level of charisma, but it's a slightly different type of charisma that I think gives those characters a distinction that is important to how they function in the story.
It's fun to see Matt Damon cast as the up-and-comer in the crew, which is kind of paralleling where he was in his career at the time, too.
I thought it was so funny seeing Casey Affleck in this after, like, this has been a year for, like, intense Casey Affleck performances between A Ghost Story and Manchester by the Sea. So, like, seeing him, you know, back when he was Ben's kid brother, you know, and the comedic relief, it was just like, whoa. Because, I mean, Matt Damon was pretty established at this point. I mean, he wasn't quite on the level of Clooney, but, you know, he was I think he was,
like, in that trio of stars. I mean, I think if you sort of break things down into, as far as the cast is concerned, it's really those three.
Have you guys looked at all into the alternate casting for this film?
A little, yeah.
The version of this film that there might have been.
With the Wilson brothers, Owen and Luke, as
Johnny Depp in Matt Damon's role.
And possibly the Coens at one point were going to play.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I meant.
He was going to bring in the Coens. Yeah. I'm trying to remember. There was somebody that he wanted instead of the Bernie Mac role.
Yeah, Bernie Mac is so good.
I know. Maybe Miss Bernie Mac. The only one not still with us.
The scene where he talks about where he buys the van. He talks about the different sorts of lotions and stuff. Fantastic.
Danny Glover, that's who we was looking for. It was supposed to be Danny Glover in the Bernie Mac role and Alan Arkin in the Carl Reiner role.
Could work.
I love Carl Reiner in this much.
I mean, the whole, practically every role in this film, he was looking for somebody else to do it. Mm-hmm. And you can see the alternate universe version where it's a perfectly good film, except maybe for the Johnny Depp thing, because I'm so tired of Johnny Depp.
Well, you weren't in 2001, though, were you?
I don't know. My
really?
Johnny
were
Depp
you on
fatigue.
Your way?
Hit, you hit pretty early.
Yeah. He was fun.
Don't front. You were into Johnny Depp in 2001.
I think you're pushing your Johnny Depp fandom.
I was into Johnny Depp in 2001.
I'm just glad I don't have to watch this in 2017 with Johnny Depp in that role and have to reassess how I feel about
and
this.
And Helena Bonham Carter then, and the inevitably in the Julia Roberts role. I wanted to talk a little more about Soderbergh's long working relationship with George Clooney, but before we move too far away from it, Scott, you were talking about Soderbergh and process and his fascination with process, and we all jumped in and moved away from that. Did you have any further thoughts on that?
Well, no, I think that he has just a nerd's interest in craft. Like, there's just a interest in his part in refining his vision and in perfecting his vision and having his films really run like a top, like Ocean's 11 does and his films after that. And I think his asserting himself on all these different fronts as an editor, as a cinematographer, is just him gaining more and more control over every aspect of the film. And Ocean's 11 is just such a showcase of, like, that machine craft, that Swiss watch quality. Is like, it's kind of a vain film in a pleasurable way. It sort of is out there as a big, it's a peacock, you know, of a film that's sort of preening for us, and it's pretty, and we admire you know, all of its feathers and whatnot. So I'm not going to extend that peacock metaphor any further.
I want to see exactly how far
but you, see, you know what I'm saying. This is a kind of a show off film, and in a good way, and I'm fine with that.
I think putting it in a slightly less peacockian version of that sort of that same thing. I've been reading a lot about how, like, people think that one of the unifying things about him is that he's just really interested in puzzles, in how the parts fit together. Mm-hmm. And his obsession with non-linearity in films possibly speaks to that, like, in an interest in finding different ways for all of those pieces to fit together. But you have projects like Che, where he's looking at, like, the process by which, you know, a man becomes a martyr, a man becomes a leader. You have movies like The Informant, which is all about the tiny little interface pieces between a man who is arguably not entirely sane, but all of the little aspects of how he interfaces with the world and how that assembles into the facade of a man. You have something like Traffic, which is about all of the different pieces of how the drug trade fits together. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a sort of an interesting argument and a way to kind of dissect some of his films.
Totally.
to pick up on something Scott said and bring it into something Tasha wanted to talk about. What you were saying about Soderbergh is like a clockwork filmmaker, or just, you know, someone who is very efficient, I guess, in filmmaking. Like, I think that might be part of why he uses Clooney so much, and other actors. Like, Clooney is not the only actor he has used. Again, even Julia Roberts is, you know, he used twice, and Channing Tatum, who we'll get to in Logan Lucky, is 4 or 5 times, you know, he's used him. So I think he is definitely a director who, when he finds an actor who can do what he wants without a lot of, you know, instruction or handholding, he keeps using them. From what I've read, he is not a director who gives a whole lot of instruction to actors, or like doesn't like spend a lot of time, you know, taking apart the character with them. He trusts the actor to do what he needs them to do. And I think Clooney does what he needs him to do enough, and that's why he kept using him at this point.
Really? That's that actually goes against my understanding of him, mostly because of, I'm pretty sure it was Full Frontal, that there are behind the scenes things on the DVD where he's sitting down with the actors and like he would give them their character information and then just have them like play that character in conversations and mm-hmm. do like a lot of improv with them where they would just had to be in character. Mm-hmm. And they actually videoed a session he was doing with Julia Roberts, who plays an actress, and he's talking to her and she's responding in character, and then he says something about her Oscar and she goes, wait, am I an Oscar winner? Am I my character now, or am I me? What's going on? I can't handle it. And then she like grabs her hair and like literally runs like screaming out of the trailer. And it's being played for comedy, certainly, but it is like it comes out of this weird exercise in like improv and role playing.
But that's in rehearsal. I'm thinking more in terms of like when actually filming, you know.
Sure,
and
sure.
He wants someone who hits their marks. You know, I mean, that's a very like blunt reading, I think, of what Clooney is doing. But, you know, I think just in terms of when he finds someone dependable, he keeps using them.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. If somebody is that interested in precision and control, mm-hmm. like finding actors who can work with his method would make a lot of sense.
And who exemplify that too. I mean, you think about Clooney and Tatum and Roberts, just the way they look and the way they move. I mean, there's a the fluidity and beauty to them, that there's such a confidence to them, to all of those performers. And it really embodies kind of the spirit of the films that he's making.
And they're controlled performers too. Like, there's probably a reason he's never made a movie with Nicolas Cage, whereas Werner Herzog has. You know, goes together better.
Yeah,
that is a really good point. So, is there anything more to say then about Soderbergh and Clooney? They've worked together a bunch of times, including behind the scenes on some things. But you know, there are the Ocean's movies and Out of Sight and Solaris and The Good German. Like, the two of them in that director and protagonist kind of face off, they've done quite a bit of.
His most beloved films, Solaris and The Good German. I actually really like Solaris remake, so that's...
Yeah.
And I love Out of Sight. We did that as a Dissolve movie of the week at some point, didn't we?
Yep.
Yeah, I remember. That is one of those movies that is incredibly satisfying to give the deep look to and dissect, because it's such a precision instrument of a movie.
Did he do more with Damon besides The Informant?
Damon was in Behind the Candelabra.
Oh, of course. Yes.
Sure.
Yeah. He's terrific in that. Yeah.
So, yes.
And what did he do with Tatum besides Haywire?
Well, Magic Mike.
Oh, sure.
And Side Effects.
Side Effects.
Yeah.
Magic Mike XXL, which is not technically a Soderbergh movie.
Yeah, but he was involved.
Yeah, I mean, he's a cinematographer on it.
Yeah, too.
Gregory Jacobs is... longtime producer, mm-hmm. directed that one.
It's a good movie.
Yeah. I think it's better than the first one, frankly.
At one point, it turns into the Stop Making Sense of male stripper movies.
We should loop back to actual Ocean's 11.
I'm trying to think what will compete with that.
Well, you know what will compete with that is just like, I want to know what you guys, as we say, it's a big cast. It's a big cast and it's a big machine. And it, to some degree, the entire movie is building up to the reveal at the end where they pull the tablecloth off the table and leave all the dishes standing. But Well, I mean, what stands out for you in this movie? There's all of this banter, and I don't actually find it all that memorable. What I find memorable, I guess, is the characters. Like, what stands out for you about this movie?
I mean, I've already mentioned it, but I love the character of Saul Bloom, and I love that Carl Reiner performance a lot. I just have a huge soft spot for it. But there are definitely shots in this movie that are very memorable to me. The one I'm thinking of in particular is the scene where they blow up the old casino, you know, and there's just this wonderful shot. There's a couple wonderful shots in that sequence of crowd shot looking out and everyone turns around except Clooney, and then a little farther behind him you have Matt Damon watching Clooney because he is tailing him at this point. And it's just, it's a very memorable shot to me, and the music in that moment is also really, really great. But then it's immediately followed by a shot of Don Cheadle watching the events, the explosion on TV while it is happening out the window behind him. Like, you know, it's just like, it's such a clever and funny shot the way it's done, you know. And there's more, but
that is that's the shot, and that is deafness personified. There's a bit in that like that in Out of Sight too, where someone is being thrown a can of soda and it just misses totally. It's just a wonderful little joke. And I think there's lots of things. We were talking about the dialogue and the snappiness of the dialogue, but the staging of these scenes plays a huge part too. And I'm thinking about the scene where George Clooney and Brad Pitt are pitching this idea to Elliot Gould. And you have this, the whole scene takes place around this table, and then they kind of leave out the part about they're walking away without saying who they're going to rob, and just the way that is staged with Elliot Gould in the background, them in the foreground, and them just dropping that information, and Elliot Gould in his open robe just kind of like working his way towards the camera. I mean, that is the joke. The staging of that just sells that joke so well.
And then like part of that same scene is when he is explaining why he hates Terry Benedict, and he's like, he tore down my casino to build some gaudy monstrosity, and he's sitting there, and he's Elliot Gould in this robe and chains, and it's just so perfect.
For me, it's always the scene where Brad Pitt rescues Don Cheadle after his latest heist has gone wrong, which that scene does not bear any examination whatsoever. I mean, he's just failed at a heist and is being led away in handcuffs by the cops. How does Brad Pitt know? Why did he come up with a costume? How did he happen to get there so quickly?
It's what he does. He's the detail man.
It's not worth thinking about. But that moment where he's like, how fast can you make something about out of what I just handed you? And Don Cheadle's like, it's already done. And then the cop car blows up. There's just, that is the level of professionalism you want out of your heist buddies, is like the ability to deal with anything with no notice.
I think there's something kind of magical about a camera floating through a casino, too, with so much going on. If it weren't for Hard Eight, I would say this is probably the movie that does it best. But it doesn't do it very well. I mean, that movie has, like, it takes on an otherworldly quality in that film. But this one, it just, you kind of capture the excitement of being there on the floor without actually having to deal with the secondhand smoke that made Vegas unbearable for me the last time I went. But in terms of the other standouts, Don Cheadle is so fun in this movie. I mean, I've never seen him be this comedic in a film before, or maybe even since then. But just the confidence which he handles this ridiculous, made-up Cockney rhyming slang.
We're Barney.
We're Barney. You know, Rubble.
You know, one, as I was reading up on this film, one consistent note I came across was that his accent is terrible, that he should be ashamed. What was he doing?
That's part of what makes it fun, though.
That's how I feel about it. Like, apparently, so many people looking back on the film are like, and it's widely acknowledged as one of the worst accents ever done in a movie. And I'm like, really? All I processed was that he's fun.
How would anybody say, oh, darn, we missed it?
Well, like, I think
of course he meant to do it that way.
I mean, you know, we know nothing about this character. It could just be an affect. The whole accent could be an affectation.
That's how I always read it, is that it's an affectation. I guess that's kind of the benefit of leaving these characters fairly loosely drawn, is you can give them more interesting backstories.
You can interpret them in whatever way makes the film more fun for you.
Yeah.
I enjoy Brad Pitt eating in every scene, too. That's a nice running bit.
Well, apparently the Cockney accent was Cheadle's choice. It was from an earlier version of the script and it had been taken out, but he wanted to put it back in. So that was his choice.
Although at the last minute he decided he felt that it wasn't working and he wanted to take it back out.
Oh,
and
really?
His agent told him he couldn't, and then he got terrible reviews and he fired her. That's what he claims in an interview, at least.
Oh, I didn't read that. That's sad.
But you're going to bring up why Brad Pitt is eating all the time, aren't you?
Oh, no, I was just saying, like, Brad Pitt eating it, like, that was his choice, too, you know? And it's great. It's, like, one of the fun things that people love to mention about this movie. Brad Pitt's always eating.
Yeah.
And he has the tattoo that you can't see. That always stood out to me is, like, you can just see there's, like, a tribal tattoo, like, on his wrist, like, coming up his hand, and you only ever see, like, a couple inches of it.
Did you watch the widescreen version?
Yes.
Because, see, I bet that there are versions where you can see more of that.
Wearing a suit.
One of the things I ran across was that, so in the scene where he's scarfing down shrimp and talking to Matt Damon, mm-hmm. like, apparently they kept shooting that, and he ate, like, 40 shrimp. that day. But one of the things I was reading was like, oh, there's a continuity error there where sometimes he's holding a goblet, sometimes he's holding a plate of shrimp. Uh-huh. In the widescreen version, there's one medium shot where you can see the two of them and he's holding a goblet. Every other shot is like chest up and you can't see what's in his hand. So there's a continuity error that you can't see in the widescreen version. And I wonder if in the same sort of way, there's shots in other versions where you can actually see his tattoo.
Well, that certainly undercuts what we were saying about Soderbergh's precision.
Formats are just going to screw you. But yeah, apparently Brad Pitt wanted his character to be eating constantly because he thought, you know, he's so busy all the time, he would never get a chance to sit down and eat a meal.
Yeah.
So, like, he figured he would be cramming food into his face whenever he had the opportunity, which I like the thought throughness of that.
It is kind of a fun tweak of the whole movie star image persona, like, because, you know, you don't look that sexy when you're eating. I mean, Brad Pitt does, but, you know, on the scale of Brad Pitt sexiness, probably slightly less when he is eating.
Especially cramming a random burger into your mouth. Well, before we go on this, can we talk a little bit about the test plot?
Yeah, we can.
I hate the test plot so much.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I love that moment of vulnerability that I mentioned over the table.
But I think that extends to the whole character, though. I think the whole thing makes him a lot more vulnerable and interesting than if Tess weren't there, if the plot to win her back wasn't central to his motivation.
It's a good motivation, and the fact that he lies to the crew about it. Like, as Scott pointed out earlier, we don't have a big betrayal plot, and we don't have the classic heist film thing where some idiot goes off the reservation and spends money, and as a result gets caught and the whole thing unravels. But what we do have here is a plot that's basically, I want to steal $160 million because I'm mad at the dude that is dating my ex-wife. And that's fine, except that her role in it is just, she's one of those dry, humorless scolds that's always turning up in movies that are primarily about men misbehaving in fun ways. And then at the end, she's like, you know what? I always liked you better than him anyway. Yes, he doesn't make me cry and you do, but for no stated reason whatsoever, since I don't want him anymore because of what I saw in the video, I want you again. And
that's not how I read that relationship. At all. Like, I don't see her as a humorless scold. I see her as someone who's been hurt and, you know, is trying to not get hurt again by a man that she still clearly loves and has tried to replace with a man who is the polar opposite of him in a lot of ways. I agree that, like, it doesn't feel like she has a lot to do here other than, like, be his motivation. But I think that as motivation, it works, and she gives a performance that shows a emotional connection there that validates his motivation.
Yeah, what Genevieve said.
Well, I think with Genevieve as well, but that is not the strongest part of the element of the film by any stretch of the imagination. But I mean, ultimately, she has to be won or extracted or removed from that situation, and she herself does not have much to do with that.
She's a bit of a trophy,
but she gets more to do in the sequel.
Including true. Imitating Julia Roberts.
Classic.
Should we talk briefly about the sequels?
I don't have a very good memory.
I have a very thin memory of everything about the sequels except the, hey, Julia Roberts looks like Julia Roberts plot.
Everybody loves the second one, though. Like, all my, like, hardcore film people are in love with it.
The second one's very much the crafty one.
It's also very French New Wave inspired and kind of has that going for it. I mean,
the problem with that one is it just doesn't work as a story. It's such an amazingly told story, and the second one is just all, like, surface pleasures and film technique, and it's fun. I'd like to revisit it at some point. I remember the third one being pretty fun too.
Yeah.
It is the series running out of steam, clearly, but still, for what it is, it's pretty entertaining.
Yeah, I mean, the second sequel felt like it was a return to the well, mm-hmm. in a way.
Back to Vegas.
Right, in a way, the second one was an experiment, and it was an extension, him trying to push himself a little bit, and third feels a little bit on the safe side, but they're a fun trilogy.
Well, in a way, it kind of feels like Logan Lucky is a fourth sequel to Ocean's 11, just with completely different cast of characters played by a completely different group of people. We'll get into that in the next half of the episode. But in the meantime, we've got some feedback for you. We'll be right back with that. So we do have some feedback on our recent episodes on Battle of Algiers, but we'll get into that next time. For the moment, because of our compressed recording schedule, we were behind on apes-related feedback. Keith, you want to kick us off with some apes?
Sure. Benjamin sent us a long and thoughtful letter about the new Planet of the Apes series, exploring a Matt Reeves interview about why CGI creation started off in the hands of directors like George Lucas and Peter Jackson. He has a lot to say in that letter, and we recommend you check out the whole thing over on Facebook, but here's an excerpt. I'm surprised you guys and many others haven't mentioned how War for the Planet of the Apes represents what I think is a major milestone in film history, as it completes the first ever trilogy where the main character of a live-action film franchise is a fully CGI creation. I think this presents an interesting future. While War for the Planet of the Apes underwhelmed somewhat at the box office, it was still a financially successful franchise, built entirely on a CGI character, and films like Jon Favreau's Lion King and Avatar 2 through 5 will continue to challenge our notion of what a film star is, what we consider animation, and how far people will go to empathize with digital creations. Do you think we'll see a greater rise in the number of fully CGI film protagonists? Or does the hassle and effort mean it will only be reserved for a small number of powerful auteurs with huge budgets? Also, as the rise of digital manipulation advances with human faces, how will we be able to judge the performances of actors, both fully CGI'd or not, when all of it could have been manipulated later in post-production?
There are a couple of really fascinating questions there. I want to take up the second one first. Whenever you're asking a question that's basically, how are we going to be able to judge people better? My knee-jerk response is, why does it matter? Why does it matter whether that's actually Brad Pitt's performance or it's slightly changed? Like, we have the same thing going on in music with auto-tune, and people are so quick to jump on judging whether something's been auto-tuned or not. And my response is usually, well, how do the results sound? And if they sound too, you know, tinny or artificial or shaved off because of digital interference, that's one thing. But if you're just looking for a way to separate authentic people from people who've had some sort of digital help, why is that so important to you? Like, I don't care whether it's pure, unadulterated Brad Pitt or Brad Pitt with tiny, tiny digital corrections. So I'm not sure that it matters, per se, unless you're an Oscar voter and you're trying to judge the best performance of the year and you're afraid that somebody might not have actually performed that performance, which is a big concern for them, honestly.
Well, I think there's also a distinction to be made between, quote, fully CGI characters and motion capture characters, because motion capture does require a performance of a type beyond just vocals. You know, we talked about that in our War for the Planet of the Apes episode, about the physicality that goes into that performance. And I think we also discussed the very smart decision to leave Caesar's eyes human, which I think is probably something that is these type of performances continue, creators would be smart to emulate, to kind of like keep the human eyes as human as possible in order to bring across a nuanced performance in a way that like that might be harder to bring through a complete CGI character.
I'm kind of fascinated by the idea of digital manipulation on a human scale. I know that Robert Zemeckis, for one, is somebody who actually goes in and tinkers with every shot in the film digitally in ways that are so subtle that we could not identify them, which is kind of scary in a way. I kind of like it. I kind of like having full CGI creations like the ones in War for the Planet of the Apes, just so I'm conscious of the fact that this is something that's being done with technology and not something that's meant to kind of fool us into believing it, something is real when it isn't. But
so you're not down with the whole removing Superman's mustache because Henry Cahill came back to Justice League reshoots?
Oh my gosh, that just reminded me of a Silicon Valley bit where the lead character nearly takes a job dealing with mustache technology.
Which also, okay, I'm going to just keep going Silicon Valley jokes for some reason, but Ocean's 11 is described, of course, by Jared as a 2001 casino heist film starring Julia Roberts and 11 men. It's one of my favorite jokes in that show. But in any case, the thing that interests me, too, about the future of this, and I think we'll see more and more of it, is how it's going to filter down to filmmakers working on smaller budgets, because presumably this technology will become more affordable and things, and something that somebody with a common laptop can do, something like what you see in War for the Planet of the Apes, and what kind of effect that's going to have on film, which could be quite seismic, I would think. But we're not there yet. It's really still too expensive to do any of this stuff.
Yeah, it is really expensive, but I do think that it's going to become cheaper and cheaper, especially as more and more of these little specialty companies get into it and there's more and more competition. As software gets faster and faster, I think that this is something that we're going to see improvements in. I think the big question as far as whether it's going to become a lot more common is kind of what happens with the film industry in terms of all of these like very escapist and fantasy related stories that we're seeing right now. I feel like the way politics is going, we're not going to run out of the desire for escapism anytime soon. But, you know, typically these kind of things wax and wane in terms of more realistic stories about people, more fantasy stories. The kind of fantasy stories that are being told today, I think, are going to rely a lot more on CGI characters, and it's going to be a lot more useful for filmmakers to have that tool. So I think it really depends on, you know, is Game of Thrones going to continue to kick off like all of these fantasy franchises where you're going to have a lot of non-human characters wandering around? If so, that's going to be a tool that people are going to want to use.
Here's another theoretical question for you. If it weren't horrible and distracting and awful and made me feel gross, who would have gotten credit for Grand Moff Tarkin's performance in Rogue One?
That's a really interesting thought.
Well, I mean, I guess you have to take into account who created the character in the first place. Like, that was building on a character that had already been created. But yeah, that's a head-scratcher.
It's not that much of a head-scratcher. I mean, we started dealing with this at least back with Zemeckis on Back to the Future 2 and his attempts to digitally recreate Crispin Glover, because he and Crispin Glover were on the outs. Like, this has been around for a while, and SAG has been dealing with it for a while. I think we're just going to end up with a lot of contractual obligations for who gets credit for that kind of thing. Hmm. SAG is also requiring us to at least do one more feedback letter. So let's have some thoughts on whether those damn dirty apes are going to be the maniacs who blow it all up. Scott, you want to read this letter for us?
Sure. Gregory in Washington, D.C. writes, I feel compelled to weigh in on the seemingly half-hearted defense of Dr. Zaius's goal to suppress progress in ape society. Your reluctant acceptance that he may be right to try to prevent the destiny of destruction brought about by human technological development was very surprising to me. Considering this to its logical conclusion, the position advocates for trusting the wisdom of theocrats to halt progress in a vain attempt to fend off a seemingly inevitable future of self-destruction. I posit this only results in a stagnant stasis of serfdom. The apes already have gunpowder, yet do not seem to exhibit the belligerent interspecies tendency of humans. Why should we assume they will make the same mistakes of nuclear-armed Homo sapiens? Furthermore, even if eventual destruction is inevitable, is it so better to persist indefinitely in arrested development than to flourish culturally and technologically, even with a civilizational expiration date? Of the many themes in the movie, I find the conflict of science, reason, and progress versus stability, religion, and security the most compelling. Ultimately, the movie shows us the horrific consequences of unfettered technological progress, but I do not think it tells us this outcome is inevitable.
I mean, I think what you've really done with this letter is kind of crystallize the question at the center of it. I don't think it resolves it one way or the other. I think you make a very good case for why it might not turn out that way for the apes, but there's nothing in the film itself to say it won't turn out that way for the apes. So yeah, I think there's a certain amount of ambiguity hanging around Dr. Zaius.
I don't think any of us are like strongly Team Zaius coming out of that movie, but like you said, it is sort of an ambiguous movie around those questions that you crystallize in this letter. And I think we were just trying to like kind of work out the other angle of that question. But also, nuclear weapons are really scary. and I think like that specifically being the future that is being alluded to here, it gives an extra, I think, weight to Dr. Zaius's point of view that if it was just like more generally technological advances, it would be, I think, a lot easier to see that as like purely villainous. But when you're talking about, you know, something that has the ability to destroy a planet, it's easier to see the appeal of stagnant stasis, as you put it.
How would they destroy it? Would they blow it up?
The maniacs.
I mean, I was thrown for a loop by this film because I think for so much of it, you're with Charlton Heston and you're upset that Dr. Zaius is denying that which we understand to be real, and you feel engaged as a rational person, as a person who believes in science. You feel enraged that Dr. Zaius takes the stance that he does, and so the ending does upend. It does at least make you question yourself a little bit. I don't think we get to a point where we're 100% on board with what Dr. Zaius is doing, but it does throw a little sand, which is good. I mean, that's what you want, some a little ambiguity.
Well, as always, we appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may feature your response on a future episode or post it on Facebook for discussion. That wraps up this episode of The Next Picture Show. In part two, we'll head across the country to North Carolina to see how a similar heist plays out in the blue-collar heartland, far away from the fountains of the Bellagio. Look for that later this week. Or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on Apple Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice. Find us at nextpictureshow.net, follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow, and follow us on Twitter at nextpicturepod, so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, we'll be shopping for a better car that is more deserving of our $13 million payoff. See you next time.
Come on, come on. Come on, come on.
Come on, come on.
Come on, come on.
Come on, come on.
Don't procrastinate, don't articulate, girl.